Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I am Michael Footer.
Every time you do that. Every single time. Is that your, that's just your broadcaster voice, I guess.
I need to be predictable.
It's true. You do need to be predictable.
You won't let me do my bit.
I will absolutely never let you do your bit. Terrible.
You can bad send footer. Me an email and I'll tell you all about the bit.
Oh, it's so bad. Don't send him emails. Anyway. Each episode will cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. We happen to have one with us today.
We do. This episode is one giant indie spotlight, and I couldn't be happier about it. We have with us today the one, the only, the wonderful is Oliver Nelson Jr. Is Oliver, how are you?
I am doing fantastic. How about y'all?
We're doing great. So glad to have you on the show.
Pandemic good.
Pandemic good. It's a modifier.
That is a statement. You know what? You should just name the episode that and just have it like Xavier Nelson Jr., Pandemic Good.
Let's do it. I don't know where this has fit on the grid. I'm chaotic meh.
Wait, no, we're not turning this into D&D. Stop it.
I wouldn't mind that.
A new game is born.
I can roll for initiative.
Okay, so we've already done that a couple times. A little bit.
So,
but we don't want to fight you.
So for our listeners who don't know, Xavier is working on a game called An Airport for Aliens, currently run by dogs. He is the writer, am I correct? The writer of Hypnospace Outlaw, yes?
I did writing and narrative design for the game to make an internet simulator shippable within, within you know, a human lifespan.
It's so quirky.
And you're working on some other stuff that we're going to be talking about as well. I want to relay a story about how I came to know you and your work. So
I love stories that are about me.
So No Man's Sky, the No Man's Sky story.
Mm-hmm.
So then you went viral for this, didn't you?
Yeah, Polygon put it up as like the best Twitter thread in
2019.
It was
at the beginning of the year.
Amazing. So there was, you know, Hello Games like slide some funny stuff into their updates, and aliens, man, and not the
aliens,
like they come at night, aliens we're talking about. So I remember just seeing that it was, how many tweets were in that thread? It must have been 20-30. It was a lot.
I do a lot of tweets, and sometimes it's justified, which allows me to do the other tweets which aren't.
I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to drop this thread if I can find it into the show notes, because I think people need to read it, and I don't want to, if they haven't read it and experienced this in the game, I don't want to spoil it. But suffice it to say, it was definitely the most memorable bit of social media platform fiction. It was so well crafted. I mean, it was nonfiction because it actually happened to you, but it was based on the game where it was fiction. It was just so compelling and so fascinating, and you wrote it so well, and I don't want to spoil it for our readers. Just know stuff got messed up.
Yeah, it's social media fiction is like gonzo journalism for the modern day, right?
Yeah.
You drink four Red Bulls,
mm-hmm,
at 3 a.m. while you're giving workshops to Central European developers in Poland, and then you write about, you know, how it inspires you to hunt a man.
I'm sorry, come again?
Come again from Miss Fudge?
I believe firmly in living an interesting life and not hunting people, given prior experience. I'll leave it there.
This is a story for yet another episode where you will come back and tell us this story.
Live from prison.
Oh boy. But why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started in the industry?
Yes. I love origin stories. Tell us your origin story.
So I, as a 12-year-old, was already going through looking at news posts, like deeply interested in the history of the medium and in the development process. I think I was like an active reader of Game Informer when you were still writing there, Mike.
Aww. Wait, were you weren't 12 when that was the case, though?
I was young. I was a child. A minor was involved. the minor being me. So I was already deeply interested in the history of the medium and the development processes. And while I was reading a post about Duke Nukem Forever, a game I was totally legally allowed to play.
100% was also definitely legally allowed to play.
You know
that
what?
Game.
You were legally allowed to play it. I'm not sure you were legally allowed to purchase it.
Good thing I had a dad.
Yeah. Good thing I didn't do either. In the middle of this article, just about, you know, the entire thing with that game, because it surely is a thing, mm-hmm. and I feel a lot of empathy for the developers who put time and energy into trying to bring that thing, who ultimately did bring that thing into life. But there was just a little blurb about game reviewers getting game copies for free to discuss them critically. And I was like, 12-year-old brain exploded. I was just like, I can get games for free? And at that point, you know, I then did the natural thing that a 12-year-old does, which is impersonate an adult and get a start as a game journalist in the video game industry. And perhaps it speaks to our medium that it worked.
Yes, it does.
Oh, I need a nap.
I have so many funny stories. Remind me to tell you the story of how I met Dave Milner, who was the former editor of Game Informer Australia.
That's a good story.
That is not a story for this podcast. And Dave, if you happen to be listening, I love you so much and I miss your face.
Aw, that's really sweet. I have a question that's actually building on your origin story. I want to know about how you went from being a baby game journalist to being a game developer. What was that journey like?
Well, you know, once they cut the umbilical cord, I was like, I'm a man now. And I decided to make video games.
Oh, man, I'm Jewish. I had to wait till I was 13.
Amazing.
In all seriousness, at a certain point, when you start in games at 12, two interesting things happen. One, you do a whole lot of stuff, which you later look back on and go, that was definitely a decision I made as a person at that time. And the other thing that happens is that you get to see the life cycle of games before you have the age to properly emotionally process it. So when I started as baby game journalist, there were people I looked up to, content creators, journalists, and so on. And over the next few years, as I, you know, became an adult, as my priorities and as my journey changed over time, the coming of age memoir I'm eventually going to have to write, where I will hopelessly elaborate on this stuff, because most of the time it was just me at 3 a.m. Writing about an indie game. The effect was deeply unsettling over time. You see all the people who you see as heroes, as better than you, as the apex of what you want to be, mm-hmm. and you see them burn out, you see them drop off the face of the earth,
yep.
you have friends that you never talk to again. So at the ripe age of like 17, 18, I was like, I will leave behind childish things, and to do so, I will make one video game before taking my exit and becoming a librarian, because I was a children's librarian after I worked for a cult.
Wait, hold on. You just kind of skated past that one.
I am going to continue skating past it. Just going to do it backwards.
Okay, that's fair. Continue.
With my inline rollerblades.
I love it.
And I decided I would make one game with whatever tools I had before I left. Using Twine, you know, this basic tool for making interactive fiction, I made a game, I released it, and people really liked it. And discovering that process is what forced me to aggressively attempt to discover what would keep me then in this industry for years to come. At first, I thought I wanted to write about games. Got burned out, got jaded as a baby games journalist, said, okay, I want to write four games. I love writing four games. I love games. I want to be in this medium potentially for life. And then I realized I don't need to write all the words. I actually care about how everything in a game tells a story, because everything does communicate in some way the narrative that the player will at least tell themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, I don't care about... I don't care about, and it is draining for me to like handle every single piece of a thing. I don't need that personal control. What I care about is making sure that a thing comes into being to an intended vision at hopefully, you know, a notable time and on budget. So I moved into biz dev and production, and now I'm a, you know, narrative director and studio director. And I feel very much at home with my role and who I am as a person at a
age where
most people don't get that. I'm very thankful for that. And it all came from very intentionally saying, okay, if I'm going to do this for the rest of my life, I need to find what about being in games actually makes me happy. And it's one reason I really admire the path that I've seen you and Mike and the collaborators you work with over time, because it seems that you've, in much the same way, had this intentional, somewhat chaotic process of finding what you care about in games, what keeps you here, and what is going to benefit the people around you to maximum effect. And you just keep finding new interesting ways of doing that, such as this podcast. So again, I'm very thankful to be here.
Well, thank you. We are so glad to have you here. I'm touched.
I'm weeping a little bit, small bit.
So two things that I want to point out. First of all, what was the name of that first game?
The first game was called All Hail the Spider God.
That's fair.
That's good. Yes. That's fitting.
And my follow-up question, is he a benevolent god? Is he a he? is she a benevolent god?
Zimforth is absolutely not a benevolent god. And you can trace a lot of actually my work today to that origin point. Finding ways of building a narrative efficiently. Finding ways to induce horror while balancing it with humor and really trying to convey the light and the darkness for a more emotionally complex experience, and grisly cosmic horrors that mirror my own feelings with God as a Christian. So it's all there. It's the whole package.
God, that's beautiful.
That's awesome. And your studio, by the way, you didn't mention Strange Scaffold, which is an excellent name.
It really is.
Is there a story behind it?
I deeply care about structures, about finding ways to build games better, faster, and cheaper in such a way that the people involved aren't able to do their best work while also not getting burnt out. So Scaffold has to do with that structuring element. Strange comes from the fact that all of my stuff is weird. And you stick those two things together and you have a studio name that you forget to bring up on a podcast where they're specifically talking about your studio.
That's okay. We haven't technically talked about your studio yet, so you were still okay. But, you know, you talked about that process of, you know, working smarter, not harder, which, again, that was part of my education in computer science. You know, you talked about that at the Game Developers of Color Expo. That was one of my favorite micro talks.
Thank you very much. It is when you are, especially from a marginalized background, I think I'm not going to attribute everything to this, of course. Personality type comes into this. But I'm deeply aware about every dollar I spend. I'm deeply aware that one day I will die. And maybe it's because a cop shoots me. And before that happens, hopefully that never happens. But before that happens, I am driven to build as many interesting things with as many good people as possible, and do it in a way that is sustainable and profitable. And if you don't find ways to work smarter and harder, to lower your dev times, lower your budgets, to find ways to connect with audiences and do so consistently, then it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. You end up in the AAA churn,
yeah,
unfortunately, where you only have maybe two or three good games in you because of how much development time it takes for each of these enormous games.
And, you know, I'm going to kind of jump. We had this question slated for later, but I think this is a really good opportunity to talk about it. You know, you do your work as a micro studio. We have been in extraordinary circumstances for the past 6+ weeks now. And I'm curious, how has the crisis and the quarantine impacted the way you work? Or, you know, perhaps the processes that you put in place and the way that you've, you know, committed to yourself and your partners to work, maybe you were prepared for that. I'm curious.
The effect of the quarantine and the pandemic that we're currently living through on my production processes and train of thought is that it has convinced me that distribution of risk is critical in games. Because look at how we typically develop. Especially on the ambitious side of indies, you get some people together, hopefully they get funding, and they say, okay, we're going to spend the next 3-4 years calling our shot in an industry where console cycles reset every 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to spend 3 or 4 years making this one game, and if it goes bust, hopefully we'll find jobs, or hopefully we get another chance to make a game again. It is no wonder that people get so burnt out in this industry, because every single project has the collective weight of their future as a creator,
mm-hmm.
and as a professional, as someone able to take care of their families. So for me, in my micro studio model, I collaborate with people a lot. I was the narrative director / narrative lead on We Are the Caretakers. I'm the story mode director of Skatebird. I did narrative design and writing for Hypnospace Outlaw. I directed Kandred's Prey. I'm now directing and making an airport for aliens currently run by dogs. People ask me, how do you do so many things? Because I do so many different things in a bunch of different roles. I try to find a way to do it sanely. But for me, the answer to it is quite clear. I don't see another way to operate while having safety. Mm-hmm. I live in the United States of America. Aside from being black, aside from having the pleasure of fearing whether I'll get shot if I walk out during the quarantine or any other time, really, aside from that, I want to have a long-lived career in this industry. I don't have, there's not socialized medicine. I don't have healthcare. Everything, every single thing I commit to is in some way, while it's an opportunity, it's also a obligation. I am not just going to do the best job that I can. I'm also in a position to give up other opportunities, give up other things. And when I look at, you know, the risk with a creative medium built fundamentally still around the hit-driven model decades after its inception, if I don't do the amount of things I do, if I don't distribute that risk, it doesn't just put me in a place of danger as a creator, it affects my collaborators. And if I am not doing everything I can to reduce the risk for the people around me, to put them in the best position to, again, do their best work in the best environment possible and be paid well for it, then I am doing them a disservice.
Man, that's powerful.
That is really powerful.
My question, coming back to, you talked about, you know, people recognize that you do a lot of different things and you, you're involved in a number of different projects. When it comes to taking care of you and taking care of your emotional health and mental health, how, given that a lot of these projects are different in scope and different in needs, and even though you're putting your stamp on them and approaching them, you know, in a similar way, or at least a similar framework,
mm-hmm.
how do you know what is too much for you? How are you able to evaluate whether taking on the next project is going to be the thing that tips you over, oh no, I've done too much?
I found that the hard way, and I very intentionally found ways to since then step that back and scale it. One of the most essential ways in which I have attempted to mitigate that inherent risk when you do work on a number of things is very carefully controlling the environments that I enter. Very carefully evaluating the environments I enter and the people that I work with. So I know it is far less draining to work on a project, even if it has a lot of needs, if the people I'm around and the environment itself is enabling and healthy.
That makes sense.
Whenever someone approaches me for a project, I ask a lot of questions and I do a lot of evaluation before I come into it to say, okay, what exactly am I stepping into? Who are the stakeholders? Who has the power or influence here? Who am I actually going to be working with in a given situation, gathering as much information as possible to make sure me and the people I collaborate with are in a position to do our best work? I also spread out my involvement across multiple things. And in that initial search for what do I care about in this medium, what do I enjoy doing, what am I good at, and what am I okay at but can get done, has informed that tremendously. It's hard for me at this point to just be a writer on a thing.
Hmm.
My thoughts are more high level. When you're writing, you need a certain level of focus. I don't take many purely writing gigs, but when I do take one, I now have the information that allows me to properly gauge how much this is going to take out of me. So again, I can make sure I'm bringing the best to each project I work on, despite having quite a few of them all at the same time.
Nice. And, you know, from a mechanical perspective, are there any tools that you use to manage your own projects and manage your contract work?
Oddly enough, Notepad++. I write down things I need to do. I get a careful evaluation of needs when I start working with people. I'm like, okay, what do you need from me? What do I need from you? What are our milestones? I nail down the exact scope of work and I just tick it off one by one. I finish something, I delete the line from that notepad. When something needs to get added, I put it on. And being able to look at sometimes a quite large task list can be intimidating. But it's also because the possibility space and the workspace necessary is so known, I can approach it with the intentionality that I try to bring to all of my work. And again, try to avoid burnout through that methodology.
It's a great segue into actually talking about some of the work that you've been doing. Because you're working on so many different projects right now, we want to hear about an airport for aliens currently run by dogs, and we definitely want to hear about the DreadX collection.
Okay, starting with an airport for aliens currently run by dogs is a first-person open-world comedy adventure game where you catch flights across a simulated universe of airports, all populated and run by stock photo dogs, fixing their problems and finding time to spend with the people you love when you and your fiancé are the only human beings left in the universe.
Aww.
It's got this mixture of, you know, very one-off, dynamic, weird stories, such as when you meet a dog who built too many orphanages and he built them too small because he read in old books that that's what humans did to be good people. And then you can just get a free orphanage from him. He just has so many orphanages, and the orphanages bounce when you throw them.
That's nice.
Systemic foundation where in a previous olden time, were frequent travelers. So you know that airports evolve and change over time. Suddenly your favorite place to eat, it is in a different terminal, or it's not there anymore, and you mourn. You take your moment of silence and you move on because you need to catch your flight in 15 minutes, and actually you couldn't wait for that Subway sandwich anyway. So in an airport for aliens currently run by dogs, every time you enter an airport, every time you leave an airport, the airports themselves change. Stores open up, stores close down. Every playthrough I do of the game and that the players run through is fundamentally different because, much like an actual airport, their goals coming into the experience, their individual journeys massively affect the way they interact with the same space. And because the spaces themselves are constantly changing, for once, I'm a narrative developer who can play my own game. Because I don't know what's going to happen exactly. And that's amazing.
Oh, that's neat.
So I guess as a follow-up question, is this aimed at Corgi gamers? Or are you just trying to shepherd in a bunch of new players?
Wow.
That was good. That was good. You know what makes that so good, Mike? It's because my brain went, oh, he said that. And then my brain went, oh, he couldn't have said that. And then my brain went, oh, he actually said that. I had to bounce between spectrums of disbelief, and that's when you know you've really done something special.
Aw,
that's nice. Also, I'm firing you into the sun. Speaking of firing people into the sun, actually not speaking of firing people into the sun, let's talk about horror. Tell us about the DreadX collection.
The DreadX collection, so we've talked a little bit about production efficiency, about making games with smaller budgets, smaller timelines, seeing how to make that sustainable because it's a possibility space that isn't really being explored, especially by, you know, our mainstream icons or lights in games.
Yeah.
So the DreadX collection came along with a very simple offer. They said, okay, COVID has occurred. Are we saying the word COVID on this?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, we're
fine. Yes. COVID, coronavirus.
The Fire Nation is attacking.
Oh no, this thing that we're dealing with.
Okay, so DreadX came together with, and they said, okay, the Fire Nation is attacking. We want to support developers how we can during this time, and we want to do something different. And they said, we're going to give each of you a certain amount of money for a small span of time. So we're supposed to make our games within about roughly 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
We would pitch it, we would know what we were building beforehand, and we would execute on it. And they said, okay, so we're going to pay you to make it up front. You're going to get a piece of the back end, and it's going to be released as a bundle so that, you know, people don't just get one thing for a funded at a certain level. They get a series of things that increases perception of value. And all the people working in this collection, from Airdorf, who's the developer of Faith, to the developer of Dusk, to newcomers or lesser known people like Torpal Duke or Soda Drinker Pro, and myself, we're all contributing to this collection, and it will look cool. The pitch is a series of 10 playable teasers. What PT was supposed to be for Silent Hill, this slice into something that could be bigger. That's what all of these games of the DreadX collection are supposed to be, while still standing alone on their own.
And so, there's a trailer for it, which we'll drop into the show notes. We'll drop the link into the show notes. And these games cover a wide variety of play styles. There's one that's like an old LCD game. There is...
I want these games directly injected
there's
into
one that,
my
that looks like a turn-based... like it's on a grid. Like it's a turn, almost like a turn-based strategy game. But I, the premise of yours is just so good, and I want you to talk about it.
Yes.
So when they came to me with this pitch, what if we funded develop? Because part of it was exploratory, because I talked to them before. They had seen an airport fanning's currently run by dogs, and they knew my philosophy. And they said, is this possible? Is this feasible? And it was took everything in me to not shout, yes. This is everything that games need that they don't currently have. The ability to build things that are compelling on shorter timelines at shorter budgets and build up streams of revenue and distribute their risk. I didn't shout that. What I instead said was very calm. Yes, I would like to make a game about Castaway if Wilson wanted you to die a slow and painful death. And they said, okay, yes. So the game is called Mr. Bucket Told Me To. It is a... surprisingly fully fledged survival game in this tropical environment. You're surviving on this desert island. You've done it for a long time. You talk to your tools, which you've all drawn faces on, and discover that you are being haunted by one of the tools of your past, Mr. Bucket, who forces you to, over the course of the game, sacrifice the tools of your survival to avoid a grimly and uncertain death. As a result, you kind of have this reverse Metroidvania experience where you're on the island, but initially take like being able to wipe your tuchus with a towel with a face on it, which is an adventure in itself.
Well, this game suddenly, is made for Mike.
Suddenly, you need to find leaves to do that, and it's so much less effective, and it's so much harder, and every day you gain a critical understanding of your own limitations as a human being, which is the deepest source of horror that I know as someone who works in the video game industry full time.
That's powerful and poignant and true.
That hit me right in the feels. Damn.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
It does.
I'll play that game.
And the DreadX collection is actually coming out in 1 week from when this episode airs. So it comes out next Friday, correct? May 15th?
It actually comes out about 2 weeks from now. So We're looking around the week of May 18th or May 25th is when you'll be able to get your name on it.
Okay, cool. I'm excited about that. That trailer, and again, the link to the trailer is in the show notes, is about 2.5 minutes of, wow, that's
different.
Oh that's, I cannot wait to play this.
That's weird.
Yeah, every developer made something within tight constraints, which are good for creativity. They made incredibly diverse projects. Every single thing is different. Like, I made a full-fledged survival game. Developer of Dusk made a horror FPS. Someone else made a card-based, like, roguelike turn-based strategy battler. Someone else made an LCD, like, Tiger mini-esque horror game that takes advantage of that. Everyone, given this space to create, not only built incredibly interesting things, although I'm a little bit biased, but they also, there was also a lot of people who weren't previously on this kick who was like, wait, you can make a game in a short amount of time with a little bit of money, and that can just be a thing that exists. And suddenly, as we get that awareness, there's this whole other path to game development that isn't really being considered that opens up, that says, what if what if instead of releasing one game every 3 years, you made three games every 3 years or more, or you made three games every 3 years and also worked with some developers in limited capacities to work on their own for revenue share or for, you know, money so that you can survive? What would it look like if game development had the freedom that had, what would it look like if game development had the freedom in terms, the freedom and flexibility in terms of its production cycles that the individuals inside of it both need and crave? This is one potential answer.
I hope that this catches on. I think it's so fascinating. I know that there are a couple of other studios that have kind of woven in smaller projects with their larger projects in order to flatten out cash flow, to bridge from one big project to the next.
The big one that we talked about not long ago was XCOM Chimera Squad.
Yep.
That was a big one for a AAA studio to be putting out like a $30 game that is...
It was a $20 game.
That's right. Yeah. It's just a regular $20 game. And that's their in-between to get to the next XCOM game. And, or get to whatever's next for Firaxis.
And if you think about it in terms of... We hear about all of these canceled projects in video games. Just imagine if 10% of them had their scopes cut down dramatically... And we did a XCOM Chimera Squad out of it.
Exactly.
What would have happened if the XCOM FPS had the same opportunity that XCOM Chimera Squad had to become a self-contained version of whatever vision it offered on the universe? If it was built with that scale in mind in the first place? Those are the possibilities that excite me in games, partially because they aren't being explored on a wider scale.
Yeah, and this comes back to your point about managing risk and this industry being so hit driven, is that we've got multi-year projects, you know, tens, potentially hundreds of millions of dollars poured into projects. And if it hits, it hits, great. And if it doesn't, you know, there's no safety net.
Nope.
And that's when you have job loss, and that's when you have studio closures, and, you know, having these smaller projects, lower risk, and who knows, something little that you do in one short-term, small budget project becomes a fascinating mechanic that gets expanded out into its own thing that you have a larger confidence is going to succeed.
God, that's beautiful. I want to be a part of this space. Sign me up.
Awesome.
We would love to have you.
I man, that could make me want to make games. I have a background in computer science. I haven't put it to any good use in, my goodness, since I left web development in 2015. So I don't know. Maybe it's time, Mike. Maybe it's time I write my first game.
I will play your first game.
I know you will.
There it is.
I love it.
Well, this has been absolutely wonderful.
It has been.
Zolliver, thank you so, so much for joining us. So excited to check out Mr.
All
Bucket
of it.
Told Me To.
Thank you very much.
I'm very excited about that. Super excited about An Airport for Aliens, currently run by Dogs. Let me ask you this. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find... my horrible tweets and my occasional good Twitter thread at Rit Nelson on Twitter, at W-R-I-T Nelson. You can follow and support my work at patreon.com/strangescaffold, where before An Airport for Aliens, currently run by Dogs, releases, you can get your dog or cat added to the game. And it can be hard to catch up on all the things I'm making, but there's a pretty good chance that I've worked on or am working on a game that you are playing right now. So just buy games, support developers. It makes a difference.
Love it. Absolutely love it.
It's a beautiful thing. Just like this episode 17 of the Virtual Economy Podcast. We did it.
Cool. We did it. And if you are listening and you are an independent developer, we love spotlighting indies. Please shoot us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz or drop us a DM on Twitter at @virtualeconcast.
And if you would like to tell Mike to stop making terrible puns, you can also send him an email. Anyway, thank you for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. This has been episode 17. You can follow us on Twitter at @virtualeconcast. I am at Amanda Farrow.
And I am at Footerish, F-U-T-T-E-R-I-S-H. You can subscribe to our RSS feed if this is your first time listening to Virtual Economy.
Welcome.
We're glad to have you. You can find us at virtualeconomy.libsyn. That's libsyn.com/RSS. We're also on pretty much every podcast delivery mechanism service. You can just search for Virtual Economy and hopefully there we are. And if we're not, let us know. We'll fix that. Please, If you are interested, if you liked what you heard, subscribe. That tells the algorithm gods that we are worth paying attention to.
That we're special.
We are special.
That it just that it's not just our moms that tell us that we're special.
And if your platform of choice allows it, we'd love if you reviewed the show. You can also send us some feedback. You can DM us with feedback or questions at podcast@fsquared.biz or on Twitter at virtualeconcast.
And we'll be back soon. We'll be back next week, definitely. We are going to have a really interesting episode next week, but we're not going to tell you anything about it. We're just going to tell you to watch our Twitter.
Yes.
In the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.
We'll see you next week.